Welcome to our Friday Five Live podcast hosted by Meg Foster. Meg has spent 20 years in higher education focused on student success initiatives and working in areas such as orientation, faculty development, online learning, student leadership, and first-year initiatives.
Well, welcome, everybody. Happy Friday. It was a little confusing because yesterday we did one of these on a Thursday, but welcome. It is definitely Friday. And love seeing many of you put where you're listening from in the chat. Please continue to do that. Melissa shared our PowerPoint today. If you've not joined us for Friday Five Live in the past, I prepare several questions for our speaker, but we always welcome your questions too. So please just make sure that you put those in the chat. And if you'll just select everyone from that drop-down menu, that means that we'll all have the opportunity to see your question, and we will make sure that we weave those in today. Just a quick kind of housekeeping detail. This does become a podcast. So Jason was asking about his video and Wally's video on today. This eventually will become a podcast. So if you want to share this resource with folks who might not be able to be with us today, there are lots of different ways to go about doing that. So welcome, everyone. So we are really, really very fortunate to have Dr. Jason Laker with us today. I hope I've got the title right here, Professor and Chair in the Department of Counselor Education at San Jose State University. Now, Jason has had a lot of different experience in the world of higher education, serving as an associate VP and Dean of Student Affairs, so as well as working, of course, clearly on the academic side of the house, and a lot of scholarly research. And one of the areas that Jason's done so much research around is this, is what's happening with our male students in higher education in particular. And so I'm really excited to have Jason here today. He and I have talked about a topic that is important to me, as I have a son who I hope who would like to be, not just we hope, but he would like to be college bound here in a couple of years, as well as the students that I interact with on a weekly basis in my classroom. So Jason, welcome.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here.
And Jason is, not, I won't say old, but long-term contributor and innovative educator. So we are really grateful for his continued support and the knowledge that he shares with us. So just to kind of kick us off, posted some statistics, about the data is showing us that we have had a substantial decrease in male enrollment in the last decade. The last couple of years have been, it seemed like, particularly significant in male students enrolling in our college environments. And just wondering, what are you seeing as some of these common challenges that seem to be prohibiting or keeping our potential male college students from coming and joining us on our campus?
Like most complicated social problems, they're usually comprised of a bunch of things, and therefore resolving them also requires a bunch of things. So it's true that there are fewer men in college than women. And right now, in fact, I just pulled that ahead of the information ahead of our chat today. So in 2025, there's about the point is that the female number is 9520 after that. So in other words, a third fewer. But it's perhaps in terms of addressing this, it's maybe too reductionist to just say, well, there's a decline in male enrollment or decline in, or that this is a male crisis, that kind of thing. It's a little more nuanced to this. So let me zoom out and say that from 1970 on till today, many more students have gone to college. There have been increases in college going, significant increases. And it's also true that women's college going has far outpaced that of their male counterparts. But we first, I think, need to situate that in some historical context. Let's not forget that it wasn't too long before that women couldn't go. And so, things like the civil rights movement, things like the women's movement, putting in historical context, this doesn't seem as strange or as stark in the sense that when you open the door to people who haven't been allowed to go, well, sure enough, more of them do. And so one would expect to see women outpacing because of that. Then there's the issue of which men and which women. And that's where we start to see more differences. For example, and I pulled some stats this morning by gender and race. And so what it remains true that there's more women than men across each of the racial categories, but it's also true that there's big differences between races. So, I mean, we'll get into more specifics, but if you start to think about humans as, you know, complex, and then we have multiple identities and stuff, and if we want to address, this student subpopulation, today we're talking about men, which is one, you know, one big category. But the point is, whichever subpopulation we who are interested in improving things, we also need to look at them in terms of identity. So there are differences when we say, why are there fewer men? That may also vary by race, to answer that. For example, if you consider even something like individualistic versus collectivist cultures. More white students are culturally in world groups that are more independent. And so the focus is on you and your college journey and the like, or whatever you're going to do. If you're in a collectivist culture, you are expected, there are norms where you're expected to do things like help out with your family's expenses. Maybe you don't leave the home until you get married. Like, there's things like that. There's also, in terms of across racial lines, big picture stats showing that economic success, you know, money is distributed differently in society. And you realize that's a fraught topic in general, certainly, but especially right now, but that's the truth of it. And so if you're talking about, let's say, Black and Latino men, so racially, they're disproportionately more likely to be in a lower socioeconomic group, not because of their innate capabilities, but because of discrimination and structural differences in how resources are distributed. I realize I'm speaking at the big picture right now. We want to get into brass tacks about particulars, but I think if you're going to get into brass tacks about particulars, it really is important to zoom out and start with what's the context. So coming back to, I'll leave all that sitting for now and come back to, before the podcast, before we started, you know, we're talking about male engagement, and I flipped it and I was like, well, wait a minute. We're talking about like the men who are there. It's often talked about how the male students in the classroom are not engaging much. They're not participating as much. And it's true. And we'll get into some of the reasons about why, which has to do with sort of the script where, you know, how we're raised to be. What does it mean to be a man, and how are you supposed to be? And there are obvious structural, conflicts between being a man and the script, and being a good student. Those two things are in conflict. And so when we get further into the conversation, that really is perhaps the core conversation is, how do we take the men who we raised to be how they are? Let's not forget, we start blaming this group or that. Men and women raise boys and girls. We are all co-conspirators in each other's problems. Okay. So we also should be co-conspirators in each other's solutions. So I also want to get ahead of things by saying, let's not make this a zero-sum game. This is not men versus women. This is students going to college with some subcategories being more than the other. And that if we want to engage or to get certain students to engage, we must learn about what their makeup is. And beyond stereotypes like men don't cry or something, we're socialized that we're not supposed to be vulnerable. Okay, let's play with that for a second. So I'm not supposed to be vulnerable, but what does it mean to be a good student? You ask for help, you recognize areas of weakness where you need to put more effort in, maybe getting tutoring, maybe you're stressed because of the college transition. That's not new. We understand that it's overwhelming, but you're not supposed to talk about your feelings. You see how everything ends up structurally, that the way all of us are raising boys and girls, let's flip for a second. The notion of being a good student often is this idea they sit dutifully, you're quiet, they're listening, they're taking notes, they're repeating back to you what you've shared with them, and blah, 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 and all of that. Not that that's good teaching or good learning, but which gender is script is encouraging someone to be quiet, docile, and, you know, receive information versus going out and being instrumental and so forth, you see? So in the end, you know, we can get into the particulars, but in the end, the solutions will have to do with intervening to modify the script or the impact of the script on the students we care about. I often, for example, talk with women colleagues and students who just like breathing, say negative things about themselves, not to shame them, because the fact is they're growing up being taught to operate that way. And so I challenge them as a teacher, as a colleague, in terms of lifting them up to recognize their talents and to know that it's not bragging to notice your talent, et cetera. So with men, I reinforce, you know, hey, that was really powerful what you said, or I know that wasn't easy for you to share with me, and I just want to tell you how appreciative I am of that. You see, these little practices, it doesn't have to be rocket science. It's true at scale, we have to operationalize some of this stuff into things like programs and services. But let me stop for a second, because, you know, I'm a professor, and, you know, if you look up the book definition of that word, we profess, and that's what I've been blathering for a while. So I'll be quiet, come up for air, and I just laid a lot of stuff out. So I want to invite you to a more to the question about any of the elements, and we'll dig into it more.
Right, right. Well, and I think our follow-up questions kind of speak to, you know, it's interesting. I mean, we have this discussion at our house constantly about, and I know we're really not here today focused on K-12 education, but it's who we end up with, right? It is who comes out of our K-12 systems, and about those systems being very much ones that reward, you can sit still for a long period of time, mm-hmm. and pay attention and interact in these ways, right? And if,
and yes,
that, and, you know, now the mom of son, daughter, like.
Yeah. Well, and I have five kids. It's nuts, but it's like, well, I'm running a gender lab, you see, in the house. So we needed the numbers.
You needed the numbers.
Yeah. But you see that even the thing you just talked about, that's not good. That's not a good educational experience, just sitting and receiving. That's like really old school banking concept of education stuff, where we like open the top of their head and pour stuff. And that's never been good. And so we have somehow conflated being docile or receptive with good education. So it's not good for women either, mind you. And as we get deeper into this conversation, you know, I actually do a webinar for innovative educators specifically on engaging male college students to advance their learning, social development, and success. And I'll pepper our conversation with some of the elements of it. But the reality is that active learning is good for all the students. The reality is personal affirmation, especially during this period where, you know, the pandemic and the political turmoil, the sort of stew of mess that happened, several years back, that had the students, you know, K-12 students at home doing things online. That was obviously we have to do what's least bad when it comes to public health. You certainly don't want people. I mean, it was a very dangerous illness and people were dying from it. So it was necessary to do aggressive things. People can debate them, but regardless. But it's still the case that in terms of psychosocial development, in terms of coming of age and, you know, at a key period, right, you know, in high school, for example, or for that matter, kids who are, you know, in kindergarten and the stress and the fear of that, and they have less capacity to understand what's happening, et cetera. So the parents in the meantime are trying to like create like a bubble to try to shield the younger kid from feeling the mess that the parent themselves are internalizing. Yet kids, you know, they can feel it when their parents. I'm not trying to digress here. I'm just pointing out, like, look at this context now, that everything I said earlier, now will we add that period? And then here we are again in a really, you know, a tumultuous time that where the mental health impacts and the learning deficiencies of that period have not been resolved. And now here, you know, education funding under threat, et cetera. Here we are again. So you had already certain constraints. And then on top of it, we have a collective trauma and individual versions of this, and that too spread differently depending on subpopulation. So I think one of the important takeaways in the big picture, and then, you know, as I said, I realize we'll get into some more particulars, but wherever people are, like this podcast, you know, it's national. We have people in different states and across the country. And so the demography of the neighborhoods and the communities vary. And so it's going to be incumbent on each of you, each of the people listening, if they want to operationalize what we're talking about, they're going to have to do some studying of what the stats are in their local situation. So at your college or university, make it a habit to look at your institutional research site and see student data. Something I want to also throw out there, because we're, you know, disaggregation is really important when it comes to making things better, like really unpacking and having a nuance to your plan that's really targeting each of the different subgroups. So a plan for male students should also be a plan that has sort of nuances across race and ethnicity, which, you know, which feeder communities and high schools are coming to your particular college. What is your engagement strategy, you know, your outreach strategy to be connecting with those feeder schools and the districts and the communities where your students come from? What is your strategy for providing activities and social connections and targeted academic supports for each of the subgroups? But another disaggregation I want to throw out there is, frankly, major. Because here we look at these stark stats and say, oh, you know, the sky is falling, there's more women in college. First of all, we'd like all of these people to be in college, and we don't need to get into, well, college isn't for anyone, because that's often also said more often among people who are fully capable and just not welcome to college. But regardless, we want anyone who wants to go, we want to support them being able to get there. And if we can start with that first principle, then another disaggregation is take a look at the patterns on your campus. You will likely see that, yeah, there's more women in medical school than men today, which, you know, is, but there was a doctor shortage. There was a shortage of women doctors before because they were excluded, and there's still a doctor shortage. So we want more people to be doctors, but that requires STEM education. That's the stuff that a lot of people are intimidated by. When your younger students are intimidated, are you encouraging them and saying, well, wait, you know, you're saying you're not good at this, but actually, if you think about it, I noticed you did well on this piece. Let's play with that for a second. And so education is about threshold concepts, which means, you know, we hit the sort of peak of our understanding of something, and then there's a breakthrough. That's the threshold concept, is at that place. So zooming back down into the campus, on your campus, if you have, for example, you know, you have your arts and sciences, you got your humanities, you got your natural sciences, you know, the list goes on, your engineering, chances are the engineering building has a heck of a lot more male students in it than female students. I mean, by far. Oftentimes, an engineering college, if they're lucky, has 25% women. Mm-hmm. Whereas, say, in education and teaching, well, more women. Humanities, you know, to disaggregate, take a look, because if you want to have a targeted strategy, not just for like recruiting male students, but, you know, a lot of times your university or college doesn't have an enrollment problem. It has a retention problem, because if you look at the dropouts, the numbers are more stark. Even if your university had more men showing up, you know, for example, some of the tech, you know, MIT or whatever might see more men because of what I just described. How are they doing? How prepared are they? How diverse is the group of men you have? What are you doing in your outreach strategies to invite and welcome and support, et cetera? So it really, even though we can go with high level principles in a conversation like this, and I really think of these as kind of like executive briefings, because each of the listeners who wants to execute what we're discussing really needs to gather very local information about their context, their institution, the patterns, the retention rates. And let me also give like a preview is, you know, one strategy, I call it internal benchmarking. And this is for really any issue that you deal with, not just gender and male students, but really anything you're trying to do somewhere on your college or university campus. In some department, some division, some unit, someone's having success with the group that you're having trouble with. So if we're talking about male students today, then what I mean by that is somewhere male enrollment and retention is going well somewhere on your campus, even if it's in like what I was just saying, let's say an engineering program. I want to know everything I can learn about what exactly they're doing over there that is feeling welcoming, comfortable, and effective in teaching and learning for those male students. What can be learned from those methods that can be incorporated into pedagogy in humanities, in education, in or the support programs or the social connection programs? Because also, all learning involves emotion. All learning involves emotion. So if you have half your population being told not to feel, not to express, and to hide your feelings, how do you expect them to learn? Because that's a key element. Social emotional dimensions of learning are key. You even though, you don't need science, a bunch of stats to say that if you're unwell, if you're depressed, if you're sad, if you're nervous, anxious, struggling, or even physically unwell, you're not going to learn. You're not going to do well in school. So if you have a group of students who are raised by men and women, so let's not blame each other here, to be more stoic or to feel that being vulnerable is weak, what are you doing to gently invite them to start trying? And I remember, this reminds me of a time I went to a campus in the Midwest, a predominantly white campus, and I was invited to speak to the Greek community, the fraternities in particular. There's a number of, I do a lot of work, for example, on gender violence prevention, and men are outpacing in terms of perpetrating it. And we don't need to get into the not all men business because this is not, I'm not interested in casting men in general in a bad light. It's just the fact is that more of the sexual assaults are committed by male students. And this is also tied to socialization, in terms of you're not a real man unless you're getting some, that kind of stuff, not to, it's more than that, but I mean, the point is that that's a gendered problem and that's associated with gendered socialization. So in this case, it's very common for the students to be required to go to a workshop on one thing or, on a prevention workshop as part of compliance. And I'm absolutely unwilling to shame people as a form of teaching. So in, I'm known, and I mean, it's not like the paparazzi's following me, but I coined the term bad dog as a verb in education. So I'm credited with that. And it refers to this shaming. Like you can't, obviously this is audio, but you can see because we're on Zoom here that I'm wagging my finger, like pointing, like bad dog, bad dog. That is what I argue is the general response to male students. I'm not interested in casting men as oppressed or as victims here. I'm just pointing out that the misbehavior that we teach them to do. I'm not saying they're not responsible for the behavior. I'm just saying we're implicated. And then they exhibit the behavior that's rooted in stuff they were rewarded for not being vulnerable, rewarded for just rubbing dirt on it and walking it off, rewarded for being physically strong, and so on, and praised, which every human needs. Like we need love, we need, to be cared for, we need to be thought well of, that's really important. And if the accolades you're getting are for bad, like behavior that's not productive, then that's what you're going to continue to do until you get affirmation for something else. And that something else will be tentative at first because it is new. So in this situation, in this auditorium of these men and many of them with the hat backwards, these stereotypes, I wasn't there to shame them. I knew why the university, made them come, but I wasn't going to show up in the way that was assumed. So I even started with, y'all probably think I'm here to tell you you're horrible people and, don't do bad things. And they're like laughing because that's kind of what they were thinking. Yes. And I said, I'm not interested in that. That's BS. There's more to this going on. And, I'm not going to, obviously, we don't have time to get onto all the bits, but let's suffice it to say, I was trying to create a situation in this big room where something occurred that we could play with in terms of affirming new behavior. And not about new behaviors and don't hurt other people, but let's just start with like being expressive yourself and having real connections with other people, which, by the way, is also good for having a better outcome in an interaction with a romantic partner. But anyway, so what happened was at some point, through these things I was saying and doing and asking questions, I kind of run things town hall style in those situations. So I came off the stage and I'm walking around with a microphone and or like a talk show. And I asked one of the guys, like in the very middle, little cluster. I mean, it was a whole room full, but these particular little cluster from one particular fraternity. And I asked a question, and one of them said something that was actually kind of vulnerable, just having to do with what he cares about, or something he enjoys about being in a fraternity. And it was a little bit of a kind of a sweet thing he said, actually. And then a couple of guys next to him giggled, and one of them said some little joke to him, kind of teasing him. And he clammed up. And that kind of thing happens all the time. And it's happened in workshops I've done. I mean, I tried, I also, by the way, I was trained as a therapist at the, my master's training was as a therapist, and my doctoral training is the study of higher ed. So I find, like, from a sociological standpoint, so I find the combination of that, like, intimate of psych and the big picture of social being together being really helpful for zooming in and out. And that's why I keep phrasing it that way. So anyway, I said, hold on a minute. I pointed to the guy who said the soft thing. And I said, I want to tell you something. What you just said was amazing. I mean, it was so lovely. Like, it was such a great answer to my question about what being in the fraternity means to you. And with you two guys, the one you kind of joked and teased. And don't worry, I'm not here to, this is me in the moment saying, I'm not trying to give you a hard time about it. Actually, I want to talk about what just happened more in terms of how we're set up. And how you were, you said something that is a little bit vulnerable, and you kind of blushed a bit because, we're socialized not to do that, not to be sweet and vulnerable and stuff. We're supposed to talk shit and whatever. Pardon me, I said it, but I keep it real, when I'm talking with students, that's how they're talking, that's how I'm talking. And I said, and you too, you were taught to be uncomfortable when that happens. And so part of the social discipline we do with each other is we'll tease or we'll make a joke to kind of lighten it but also to kind of discipline the person not to do that. And I say, this is what I'm talking about. And then I looked at, then I zoomed out, like I used the phrase and I waved my arms big and like gestured to the whole room. I said, you all constantly talk about brotherhood. And I was in a fraternity. You talk about brotherhood, what does that really mean? I mean, that's the camaraderie, it's the caring for each other. That, I mean, if we're really talking about what that really is, it has to do with support and care, and that we're safe with each other, that we encourage each other, this kind of thing. So why then, when we decide to actually try that, we give each other a hard time? So again, I'm not interested in giving any of you a hard time. We were raised this way. But I would just say, if we're all going to make it through, if we're going to do well here, if we're going to have a good life, if we're going to perhaps in the future, whether it's a family, a good job, all these things require real connections with people. And then I get into particulars about, particularly gendered elements. And there's a lot we can get from, earlier I remarked about the women's movement or the more girls and women going to school and stuff. What we learned is gendered strategies work. So stop talking about it's a problem that there's more women. Good. I'm glad they're here. We need a gendered strategy for men. And that's what I'd like to talk about.
Okay, so lots of my brain is going lots of
I'm
places.
professing again.
So
Sorry.
my first thought, well, I definitely want to make sure we talk about mental health because that's
Yes.
something that I think is so important with this population, and I think speaks to that being okay being vulnerable, right? Like
Yes.
you can't address your mental health if you're unwilling to be vulnerable. But I also would love to talk, and this is not on the question list, but how do we do gendered work in a world where we're not supposed to talk about DEI, in a world where now we're supposed to, as of yesterday, use the Department of Education website to submit
I
evidence of that?
okay, I that's I think we're conflating a couple of things. First of all, DEI is undefined in the discourse you're referring to. It's a political operation that we don't need to indulge because and I'm saying that without getting into particulars about any politician or whatever. I'm just saying that's apples and oranges. That a directive to stop DEI without defining what it is clearly not a directive to stop, the
And
particular.
I agree with you. I just know that there are probably some listeners who are like, I really want to do this space, but I may do this work on my campus. but there is this current push-pull. I mean, I'm not trying to be
Well,
sarcastic,
no,
but
I no, not at all. I think it's I'm glad you raised it because I think one of the things we're caught up in is which words we're going to use. And the truth is that even, before DEI, you hear phrases like anti-racism or decolonial, whatever, and those are really triggering to some parts of society. And then DEI was like the softer version. But the thing is, either an institution was doing well for each of its different categories of students or it wasn't. So saying that we're, whether it's called this, that, or the other, is it working? Is it sincere? Are you improving things? Because there's nothing about that discourse and that, or even that Dear Colleague letter that stops us from identifying the students in our institutions who are struggling and approaching them with support and services, regardless. I mean, that's the thing is, there's a difference between who's disproportionately more likely to experience something versus the question of the availability of the support. The support is available to any student who is struggling with, like, say, tutoring is served, math tutoring. It's for any student struggling with math. Writing support is for any student struggling with writing. It happens that on your institution that there are statistics about which categories of students, not just things like race and stuff, but as I said earlier, even things like which majors. So there is nothing about what I'm saying that is, advancing any sort of exclusionary political agenda. It's inclusive in as in every single student of any race who's struggling, we want them to be supported. And by the way, let's not lump all white students into one category either. There's great diversity in each racial category. That's one identity, but each person has multiple identities. So there's different socioeconomic status. So for example, on your campus, among the white students, those who are on Pell, those who are more likely need financial support, those who have identified disabilities for which an accommodation is needed are going to have more struggles than the white students who don't. So let's not like fall into some trap where we're not allowed to or think that we're not allowed to look after each one of our students. Each of our students has a set of identities, and we are going to support each of them. And that certain subgroups of students have more or less of a particular, struggle is about that and the struggle, and we'll address it. So that's my advice is just kind of stick with that kind of stuff. And this is and I'm saying this openly. This is not hiding. This is not trying to get around something. That's why I'm saying like we get caught up in rhetoric of what we're currently calling, diversity stuff, which is different than what it was in the 90s or the 80s or the 70s or what it'll be later. I don't want to get pulled into that. I want to get pulled into what's going on with my students and where on my campus are students doing well? What can I learn to bring to the other parts and where are they struggling and where can I intervene? And by the way, there's a quote by bell hooks. Bell hooks, who's a Black feminist scholar, writes, the first act of violence that patriarchy demands of males is not violence toward women. Instead, patriarchy demands of all males that they engage in acts of psychic self-mutilation, that they kill off the emotional parts of themselves. If an individual is not successful in emotionally crippling himself, he can count on patriarchal men to enact rituals of power that will assault his self-esteem. The story I told of that little interaction in the auditorium is exactly that. It wasn't a big, ugly thing that happened. It's very subtle. That's how it generally happens. Yes, there are big fights or people screaming slurs at each other. That's true, but that happens less often than by far than the little interaction I talked about and how there's opportunity to intervene, which is what I modeled by explaining what I did. And the rest of the, and then it was disarmed. Everyone, like at that point, I have an auditorium full. I did that in a way that was respectful, that was kind, that was supportive, and it showed them that it was safe to open up a bit. I modeled that. That was my responsibility. I wasn't there as a classroom instructor, but it's more or less the same. I was the teacher, and I will take responsibility for good teaching and learning. And that means I need to model being vulnerable too. And I happen to be a man, so I will sometimes speak in first person about what scripts and how it, you know, what I think about it and why I think it's impossible and so forth. But I've also had, especially in education where there's more women than men, over the years in conference presentations, I've had women colleagues come up and say, you know, I've heard it's important to have a male role model, but, you know, so I don't know, I feel like I'm not suited, or can I do this or whatever. I reject that. Absolutely, you can. It's not like we get so caught up in this idea. Of course, we want to see representation and, you know, instructors and teachers and staff of different categories of identity, like the students at their school. But it's also true that I have many sayings, and one of them is you can't tell your friends or enemies by looking at them. For example, women often slut shame each other. I'm not saying that to say bad things about women. I do research on sexual consent and violence prevention and have seen, and there's plenty of stats that that happens, lateral stuff. People of color, black people, for example, or brown people or Latinos, for example, you know, that within culture, sometimes, you know, who's the real one, who's the good one, you know, the discourse that happens within community. And then there's, of course, discrimination and harmful rhetoric across identities. But let's not get caught up in the belief that each of us, regardless of our social identities, you can have, this is multicultural skill is what it is. So you can learn skills to be effective in engaging students of different categories. And of course, I work on a campus in Northern California that is incredibly diverse. And I have relationships with a bunch of, you know, with all the different communities. And it's a joyful thing. I love it. But it also, it's not just the relationship for its sake. It also helps me have insight into what the sort of disaggregated, you know, like what are the ways this struggle plays out with this community and how can that inform strategy. So the male script, if you will, the masculine script rests on four pillars. And I mean, there's others. I like a model by O'Neill, but I mean, there's others. So I'm not trying to tout just one over another, but I do find this one really easy to understand and accessible. So he writes that the four pillars are restrictive emotionality, socialized control, power, and competition, restrictive sexual and affectionate behavior, and obsession with achievement, work, and success. And even at face value, we're familiar, you know, I'm sure even if someone hadn't heard that before, that's, yeah, that kind of sums up what the script is. It doesn't mean every man exhibits things the same way in each of those categories, or that the same thing with women's beliefs about it, because that shapes our experiences too. But those are the four, and I realize just for limited time that I won't be able to get deeper into each of the four, which is what I do in the bigger webinar. But I do want to read one quote that's important and then move into, I do want to offer more particular strategies or categories of strategies. So because the sort of the glue or the facilitator of all of that is shame. Not living up to whatever the model is. Think about body shaming of women, the image on the Vogue magazine or whatever. Even that person doesn't look like that, really. You know, there's airbrushes, you know, manipulating the image, etc. And so we all have these sort of carnival mirror versions that we're provided. And so the impact, and so shame, this definition of shame I really appreciate by Kaufman and Raphael says, to feel shame is to feel seen in a painfully diminished sense. Our eyes turn inward in the moment of shame, and suddenly we've become impaled under the magnifying gaze of our own eyes. Even when other people are present and watching, we are watching ourselves, but we actually mistake the watching eyes as belonging to others. And the reason I like that quote is it really talks about the way that operates, that we are presented constantly with a dominant image that is not even real, that we can never attain. And then we are constantly subjected to shame for not reaching it, but it becomes socialized and internalized to where we're actually the ones doing it automatically, looking at our own self in the mirror. Think about what is the first thing that comes to your mind when you get up in the morning, you go in the mirror, which isn't usually when we look our best anyway. So, you know, so anyway, and moreover, shame, James Gilligan writes, the emotion of shame is the primary or ultimate cause of all violence. The purpose of violence is to diminish the intensity of shame and replace it as far as possible with its opposite, pride, thus preventing the individual from being overwhelmed by the feeling of shame. So why are we surprised then if one guy says some kind of diminishing thing to another guy that's to the effect that he's not a real man? You name it. And usually it's some feminine term, which, that's plenty to talk about too. And so is he gonna respond with, if he's witty, so he responds verbally, but he may respond by hitting. This explains why. And so the strategies, there are five that I really work on. And then, as I said, they have to be customized, at the local situation. But the five are involve developing a foundation of reflection and awareness, which is kind of much of what we're discussing. I have one called Engage the Middle 60, which refers to that. I was in student affairs, eventually dean, vice president of student affairs, dealing with student discipline, for example. And what I found, because I would work on things like alcohol abuse issues or whatever, which again, many more men than women in the meetings, the disciplinary meetings. So about 20% of the men get their name on an incident report at some point. That was what was going on. It doesn't mean necessarily something big, but, it just happened to be when the RA popped by the room and there were five people and they had a beer in there or something. So it could be something like that. And then there's in terms of, you talked to earlier about student engagement, like leadership, getting involved on campus as student leaders and that kind of thing, which is more women than men these days as well, for many of these same reasons. But so about 20% of the men are like those guys who are engaged. We really love working with them. They're the ones we want to hire to be resident assistants. I question, by the way, have a conversation internally. Are the RAs we pick, and we're talking about in the residence halls, but really any other peer program, are the ones we hire for these roles or even teaching assistants, are they the ones we're most comfortable with or the ones the students are more comfortable with? And it's usually these, it's in, I worked in Canada, the word keeners comes up. The keeners are the ones we want to work with because we enjoy them. They're enthusiastic, of course. I can understand that, of course. But the middle 60 refers to that literal middle 60% of guys who are just going about their business. They're not causing trouble. They're not sticking out. They're just doing their thing. To me, that is enormous capacity because 60% is a majority. And you just miss them because they're quiet. We can, and so my recommendation in that category is you actually go, remember earlier I said things like, hey, that was really thoughtful, or noticing and making comment. Someone, a guy in class says something thoughtful or interesting, hey, that was really sharp, or that was really creative. But also the culture of invitation is related to that. I used to go, for example, to campuses, talk with student leaders, and they would complain about apathy. And the best definition I ever, like how hard it is for them to, for other, to them to have enough students involved. The best definition I ever heard of apathy is when they're not interested in what you're interested in. You call it apathy. So I asked them the question, how many of you sought the position you're in? Like you saw it as an opportunity, whether you had to run for it or apply to it, and you took it. Obviously, no surprise, almost all of them raised their hand. I said, how many of you were invited? How many of you had someone come up to you and say, hey, you're really talented at this, or I really like the way you think about that. And we would really appreciate if you would get involved, or we're doing, or even just for one event, we can really, you're so artistic. We really need help with our posters or whatever. That is a very simple strategy that someone can do immediately, but we tend not to. And that middle 60% is waiting. It's just there. You could be approaching those guys and noticing, if you just are, observing them for a few minutes, you probably see something worth mentioning, or complimenting or whatever. And you approach and you introduce yourself and you say, hey, I noticed this about, or that you said this, or that you're doing that, and inquire and so forth. This reminds me when I used to, dean or VP, whatever, I have the counseling center reporting to me. And they were, men and help seeking. There's fewer male clients and stuff, and they'll talk about men aren't coming. I'm like, get out of your office and go out there. They're taught not to come, to be seen showing up in your waiting room to sign up for it. That's a big ask. You have to first go out there. I would actually say, like, seriously, go sit on the porch of the fraternity house, have a beer, go shoot hoops, like do something. And because just like with the arts, I've had colleagues in there say it's hard to get. It's like getting pulling teeth to get men to come to the shows, but once they come, they stay. And that really stuck with me because that's true with this stuff too. If you actually observe, notice, approach in a kind way, something, because again, with these, with the way the socialization works, men have no good reason to think someone's going to approach them in a kind manner to invite them to something. So give them a nice surprise. And what do you know? They will likely respond because people need care, love, etc., like I was saying. And so the fourth strat, the third one, of course, gender-informed pedagogies, which is a cross-cutting everything we've been talking about. I put invoke, invite, and inspire utilizing masculine script narratives, which is just a fancy way of doing what I did already, is like that story I said about in the auditorium, is I was using what I understood about male scripts to inform how I approach them. When I was a dean of students, for example, I would have, men come in for just, they get caught with whatever it was, beer or whatever. They come in. I'm not interested in shaming them, and I don't find it very interesting to talk about whether he had the beer or not. That's 30 seconds. A discipline meeting might be 30 minutes or more. I don't want to talk about whether he had the beer, and I want to talk about what he doesn't like about being sober. I want to talk about how he's doing in school. And I would have situations where guys would come in and they were in trouble from alcohol stuff. We got caught with it. And whereas student affairs, this is a problem for student affairs too. It socializes people to focus on the beer and not on the person, despite what we claim to be good at. And so I said, tell me more about what was going on. And he's like, well, I'm kind of shy. And so when when I drink, I open up, I'm making jokes. People like me. It's funny. I appreciate it. I mean, that's pretty significant for him to say that, be able to say that. And then my counseling training, comes back with, when did you decide that you're only worth being around if you're drunk? And then I let that, and then I go quiet for a second, and the tears come. I'm not trying to make people cry. I would rather say unburden, because that's what was really going on. That's the shame. How hard was that to do? It was easy. But not unless you're intending to do it. We're not being intentional in a gendered way with our male students. And we can be, and it doesn't require us to be mean to women. On the contrary, many of the struggles women experience on campus have to do with their male peers. When men are more like in terms of student development, the stronger your psychosocial development, the less likely, this is, I mean, it makes sense at face value, but as research affirms this, the stronger and more advanced your psychosocial development, the less likely you are to be due to say racist things, sexist things, to hit people, to abuse alcohol, to use drugs. I mean, other than recreationally. I'm in California, so I'm not going to be shaming people. But anyway, the point is that it is worth it. For bigger reasons, there's things this does to advance. Like, if in terms of retention, to have someone feel like we're glad you're here is one of the biggest retention strategies there is, and it's not happening. But we're just talking about the male crisis and what's going on with the men. What's going on with us? What's going on with us as teachers, as administrators, as staff? What's going up on my whole dissertation was about what's missing in, professional training for student affairs people in the curriculum, even to this day. Almost no content specifically about masculine gender role socialization because of an old true story about how early social theory, the psycho theories that we rest on were derived from research with affluent white men and liberal arts college. People who've been around know have heard that, and it's true. But the thing is, that work did not produce gendered understanding. They were looking at those men as students, not as men. And so what you get are models that certainly privilege men. Like there's a term androcentric, they're androcentric, if you will, but they don't really tell us anything about men. And then when there was critique about that associated with things like civil rights, women's rights, and all of this, then you get particular research, women's ways of knowing and a different voice, the Gilligan's work, et cetera. And more now you can find in journals, experiences of Black women student leaders in a predominantly white campus focused with this particular, like you get all of these very really robust body of research about particular social identities. And that, by the way, does include men. I'm literally the editor of the Journal of Men's Studies. There is plenty of stuff out there for people, but it's not included in their training. So those people who are listening, I encourage you to read. I'm not trying to sell books. My first one was called Masculinities in Higher Ed, but there are plenty out there, not just mine. And I really encourage people to go back and do a bit of reading. So The last one is model authenticity, vulnerability, and empathy for the struggle, which again, I've been kind of modeling in this conversation. So I've kind of woven these pieces. But I'll again be quiet because I know our time is limited.
Yeah, our time is kind of wrapping up. We're going a few minutes over, but just maybe to kind of bring it all together. All right. So I've taken so many notes. When we're in the classroom, when we're in the advising office, we're going to model this vulnerability for our students. I mean, what I hear you really saying is using some of those, I too have that counseling background, Jason, really kind of leaning into that skill set, which I know scares some people because a lot of faculty don't have that kind of background that they bring to their work. How can we be more encouraging? Are there specific things that you would recommend we think about around the idea of helping to create belonging, encouraging use of resources? Like I'm thinking at my own college, we do timely MD because we don't have counseling centers in our community colleges, right? And it's interesting, the male students engage with the chat, the female students actually do the counseling sessions, right? Like I just think of that very simple.
Yes. You know, in the journal, I just received an article. It's obviously not yet, it's being reviewed, but it had something caught my attention, was talking about how if men are taught not to express emotion, another way to put it is they weren't taught how to, the names of things. There's a psychological term, alexithymia, which refers to not having words for emotion. So men and boys and men have a full range of human emotion, of course. But much like with crayons, say the big Crayola box of 60 or even more. And then we get two, black and white, on or off, full blast, anger or whatever, yelling or whatever, or stoic. There, it's in there, but you have to help. You can't identify it if you weren't raised, you're feeling this, you're feeling that. Like raising of kids, oftentimes the girls are receiving more particular detailed, feedback about the name of the emotion they're expressing. And the boys are more often getting, told to stop crying. So we when they show up, that's what we have showing up. So we have to show and be able to say, hey, it looks like you're really struggling there. Like you seem like you're really burdened today, or like you're really having a hard time. So, which is kind of a bit very generic, big, because it's a little early yet for chapter five, where he specifically identifies the sub emotions or whatever. Right. But just, I see you. You therefore he receives that I care about him, that he matters. And of course, it's not just emotion. Obviously, there's instrumental things. Your math class you're struggling with, or you're having trouble with your writing. Let's talk about that, because I know you have a lot of good things to say. Or, math, a lot of people are intimidated by, including just growing up believing they're not good at it. Let's take a look both, not just at the particular math problem, but let's talk about, what's your history with math? Like, what's your relationship? What did you hear told to you about whether you're good at, like, these kinds of things, to help make connections between the tactic of the skill that needs to be worked on and that social emotional scaffold that's, right, affecting it. So these, it's harder to be more specific than that in this kind of venue, because it will depend which department the person's in, which major they're working in. But I'm hoping that the things we talked about today are sort of a structure or a model, and that I really want to encourage the people who listen to this to take a look specifically at their campus, where people are, how they're doing in terms of enrollment, in terms of performance, in terms of applications, retention, things like this, and you will find patterns. Then you can go deploy yourself and your colleagues and student peer leaders and others, with a focus on whichever area to take this strategy that those engineers are doing well with, and let's build that program in the, social science or something. There are a lot of things people can do that will really turn things around. And by the way, higher retention is not just good for the student, it's good for the stability of the institution.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And an important reminder that there are a lot of, I feel like I sit in so many meetings right now where we're talking about all the things we're not doing well. So it's important to remember there are pockets on campus.
Yes, absolutely.
And tap into those as resources for what's working with your population,
And they can't, and someone can't disarm you by saying, well, that may have worked where you were, but it won't work here, because it is working here. It's working right across campus. Don't tell me that, you know?
And another theme I'm taking away from our conversation is this idea of invitation. Like I'm thinking about these closed off students who I'm teaching, who I desperately, I mean, you know, we talk a lot about care and belonging in our class, and how can I be more intentional about my invitation to
do your office hours at the coffee shop. Or at a place where students go enjoy themselves organically, you go there.
Right, be with them. And I don't call them office hours, I call them coffee hours. Carol's asked the question, is it possible to receive this presentation? Yes, anyone who signed up today will receive this as an email to them, or it will show up on their go-to knowledge dashboard. Jason, I do wanna, we're gonna wrap up today, but I think I could talk to you probably for several days and just never tap into all the knowledge that you've shared with us. So really grateful for your time today. As a reminder, there is a survey. This helps us shape content. So Jason, we had had some folks talk about concern around male student enrollment and retention. And so glad we could bring you on to discuss this really important topic. Next Friday, same time, same place, we are going to be talking about ADA and accessibility and how to do that work in a changing world, also with new regulations that we need to meet. So some very, you know, practical things we can do to make sure that we are living into that space for our students. So thank you so much, Jason.
Thank you very much. And the Engaging Male College Students webinar that IE has of mine is in the collection too, so we can refer people to that as well.
Thank you. Thank you. Well, always, I hope everyone finds time for rest and renewal this weekend. I think that's so important given the world that we work in and the work that we do. So appreciate your time on this Friday. And Jason, I look forward to more conversations with you in the future.
Thank you.
Thanks, everybody.
Friday Five Live is brought to you by Innovative Educators. Innovative Educators offers 6 online services for your onboarding support and training needs. Visit us at innovativeeducators.org to see how we can support your student success initiatives.